She's like one of those Western characters portrayed by Clint Eastwood, who rides into town and battles the corrupt city. And so imagining that I had a 19-year-old pregnant labor activist as my Clint Eastwood really drove the novel.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, introducing Jess Walter, author of The Cold Millions, a last-gasp Western set in Spokane, Washington, at the beginning of the labor movement and at the height of the free speech riots. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Jess, I read your book, The Cold Millions, as an advance copy, so I didn't see the map that is at the beginning of the book. So I'm wondering, can you describe for me and for our listeners what this map looks like? And I don't know, maybe set the physical scene of the book for us?
Yeah. The map is of the sort of the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, which is the setting of the novel, from Seattle to Spokane to the Coeur d'Alene, as they were called, the mining district of Coeur d'Alene, Wallace, and then all the way into Missoula through Taft, Montana. And it's really about the labor battles of the early 1900s, 1909, centered on the free speech riots in Spokane, Washington, and two itinerant brothers, Gig and Rye Dolan, who gets swept up in these early labor battles, and especially Rye, who gets tags along with a real historical figure, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, as she goes around the Northwest raising money and awareness for this labor cause.
I'm wondering what it's like as a writer of fiction to write about a place you know so intimately, Spokane, Washington. How compelled are you to keep landscapes and landmarks true to fact when, I mean, if I can say this, your novel is very place-based?
Yeah. It's interesting. I think there's an old saying that the past is a different place. And I think writing about Spokane in 1909 was a very different experience. Spokane was one of the most thriving cities in the country at the time. If you think of mining and timber and the railroad as the early internet, Spokane was the center of Silicon Valley. It was, you know, seven main railroads came through this place, taking the mining and timber money from Idaho and Montana out to the rest of the world. And so in some ways, there is a sort of familiarity, but in other ways, you know, you're writing about these packed streets and streetcars and Model Ts, and, you know, really writing about a different time and era. And so, yeah, I've written other books set in Spokane, and there's a point always where I have to fire the research department and just turn it all over to the fiction people. And so, for instance, I really wanted the book to start in one of my favorite spots, a baseball field in the middle of Peaceful Valley. It wasn't until I was about halfway through writing the novel that I realized that baseball field was put in 1911, and my novel starts in 1909. And so I just said, this is where the fiction writer wins out.
I'm wondering what pleasure you find in that hybrid fiction, fiction that uses elements of history with historical figures and, you know, your imagination.
You know, I first did this in one of my earlier books, Citizen Vince, which is set in the 1980 presidential election. And I almost came across this by accident. The protagonist of that novel, Vince Camden, is trying to decide who to vote for in the 1980 presidential election, Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan. And I always knew that book would take place over 7 days. And as I wrote the book and plotted it out, I realized I was missing a day. I had an entire day where I had no action. My character was flying back from New York, and I thought, what if I put Reagan and Carter in the book? And so I wrote Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan as characters in this book. I checked in with them on the sixth day of my 7-day novel. And it was kind of thrilling to take real characters and have them exist in this fictive world. For me, it's a little like location. It's interesting you started with location, because I think location can really ground a place. If you know, you know, the streams of Montana, and someone gets that description right, you feel it, and it has this sort of verisimilitude that I really like. And so I really loved doing that. Richard Burton is a character in my novel, my novel Beautiful Ruins. But this is the closest I've ever come to writing pure historical fiction. And for me, there were a couple of reasons that I wanted to do it. One, I felt like this was a period of history that needed more attention. So because of that, I wanted to be true to many aspects of the story, like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, this 19-year-old pregnant labor activist. I felt like more people should know about her. And so I didn't want to invent some Elizabeth Gurley Flynn-like character. Sometimes you come across these historical moments that are almost too unbelievable. You have to just portray as they happened. And so I think that was the first thing. I'm a journalist by training, and I feel some responsibility to get the facts right too. And so now that said, there, one of the difficult things is when you have the real story, then you're a little bit fenced in by it. You can't go beyond that place. And so that becomes the tricky thing, having Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's real experiences in 1909 alongside your imagined characters.
In the book, she is pregnant and she's so young. She's a union organizer. I'm wondering if you can talk further, maybe, about the role that women play specifically in the novel, and particularly among so many men.
It's interesting. As I was conceiving this novel, I've never written what you'd call a Western, and I kept thinking, this is kind of like a Western. It's the dawn of this period in this town. It's those forces of violence and environmental and degradation and the subjugation of Indian tribes. You've got all of these elements. As I was thinking of it as a Western, I thought, because Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, this real character, comes to Spokane to organize the labor movement and battles against the forces in the city, she's like one of those Western characters portrayed by Clint Eastwood, who rides into town and battles the corrupt city. And so imagining that I had a 19-year-old pregnant labor activist as my Clint Eastwood really kind of drove the novel. Now, while she's kind of the hero of the novel, she's not the protagonist, though. The protagonist is Ryan Dolan. And because this is a real historical figure, and because she's so audacious, I mean, at 19, she's standing on street corners demanding the emancipation of the vagina, and, you know, and 10 years before women have the right to vote. And because you can't really invent a character like that, and the agency with which she acted, even though she had none, she couldn't own land. When she first arrives in Spokane, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn is told by the other labor leaders that she's not allowed to speak on the street. The answer I give her in the novel is, I have organized from Maine to Montana, and never once have I been allowed to speak. I just loved that sense of audacity that she had. It almost felt better to me in the novel to have her be a somewhat smaller character so that you weren't overwhelmed by that. That's not the world that exists. That's the world that she is sort of single-handedly trying to create. And because of that, I wanted another female character to talk about another kind of female agency that would have existed. And so that is Ursula the Great. She is a vaudeville star who comes out and sings and dances with a live cougar and has to manage the corrupt businessmen and the cops and that whole world. And it was interesting creating those two female characters with their very different kinds of agency. And because we mostly at first see them through the eyes of Gig and Rye, the protagonists in the novel, it was also important to me that to write from their points of view. And so throughout the novel, I have other points of view bubble up, these first-person characters. And it was, in both cases, I really loved writing both those characters and showing their different versions of 1909 and what it would have been like to try to affect change as a woman.
And you actually have another female character in the book who I am and was particularly fond of as I read. I loved the passage that takes place about a quarter through the book. It's a chapter called Gemma. It's told from the perspective of what some might call like a minor character, but the conversation being had between Gemma and her husband reveals so much about other characters in the book. And I think it actually reveals a lot about you as a writer. It ends kind of on a very humorous note. And I'm kind of hoping you might be willing to read that passage for me. Maybe starting with the paragraph that starts, "I sat up in bed."
Sure. I'll set Gem up a little bit if that's okay.
Yeah, please. So
one of the things I really felt a responsibility to do in the novel was to talk about the fact that, you know, in this incredibly short period, Spokane doesn't exist in 1864, which is the first moments of the novel. And 50 years later is a city of more than 100,000. And witnessing that is a Native American character named Jules. And Jules gets swept up like Ryan Gigdo in the free speech riots and gets pneumonia in jail after being beaten pretty brutally and goes to live with his niece at the end. He's released from jail and is incredibly sick. And he goes to live with his niece, Gemma. And this is Gemma and her husband, Dominic, who is an Italian machinist. And they're in bed while and they're worried about Jules possibly dying because he's so sick. And this is from Gemma's point of view. "I sat up in bed. There was one story he used to tell about an outlaw who stole their ferry boat. In the story, Jules was 12 or 13, working on Plant's cable ferry. One day, two outlaws stole the ferry, cut the ropes, and escaped downstream. Jules tracked the men from the shore on horseback as the raft rode the current downstream to the falls. One fell off, and Jules kept expecting the other to swim for shore. Instead, the man simply rowed the boat over the falls. 'Maybe he couldn't swim,' Dom said. 'Maybe,' I said. 'But Jules said the man didn't look scared, not the way someone would if they couldn't swim. He seemed almost eager, and right before he went over the falls, he sat up and called out, "Watch." "Watch?" Dom said. "Watch." Jules yelled from the riverbank, 'Swim, you idiot!' But the young outlaw just waved and went over the falls. Dom waited for more, but there was no more. "And he died?" "Well, of course he died," I said. Dom just stared ahead, as if trying to picture it. "Huh," he said. "Jules said if the kid jumped off the boat and swam to shore, he'd have been arrested and hanged. But as long as he stayed on the boat, his fate was his own. I think that's why Jules liked the story, and why he rode the rails instead of moving onto a reservation. I think he came to believe it was better to choose your life, and then even choosing your death was better than letting someone else choose your life." In bed, Dom sat with this for a moment. Finally, he opened his mouth to speak. "Oh, how I loved my sweet, simple husband." I put my hand on his thick, hairy arm. "No, darling," I said gently. "I don't think Uncle Jules would want us to put him on a raft and send him over the falls."
Yeah, I loved that passage. As I was trying to, you know, write questions for you, you know, this idea that you kind of repeat the story through different characters and through Jules many times up until this point, this trip over the falls. And it kind of reminded me of the way that history is repeated. And I'm wondering, like, how you think of history in this way, that it can be rewritten.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at that episode in the novel, and I think it's apt. As I was working on this novel, I even though I'm writing a historical novel, I felt very much like I was writing a contemporary novel. The issues that they're dealing with, civil disorder, riots, police brutality, labor, income inequality, all of that felt so current and of the moment. And that idea of history repeating, of it being a story that we tell with different meaning, but that things go over the falls, that the river just keeps flowing, was something that just kept coming back to me. And at the heart of the story of this stolen ferry boat that Jules witnesses as a young man is the kind of birth of this city, is the origin story of this entire place. And even he admits that stories change like people do. And I kind of love that about Jules, that in that moment he changes. But I think it's a question that keeps coming up. We throw ourselves into these causes. We long for social justice. We want things to get better. And do they? And how do we take the sadness and loss and of things not working out? And for me, that story, revisiting that story, is to revisit the central question of the novel. When you work, when you do these things, if it doesn't work, then what? And I love in that moment that, you know, Gemma and her husband Dom are trying to consider if Jules dies, how they will take care of him. And they don't know any tribal religious beliefs that you might have, they're not sure what to do. And, you know, and Dom, for a moment, she sees it cross her husband's mind that he might want to send him over the falls.
What can you say about discomfort? How it's used, as I kind of saw it, as a literary device in the novel, and how it's written about in the book, because there's a lot of discomfort written about through characters' actions, through things that happen to the characters, yeah, too. There's a lot of violence, but there's also racism, which kind of, for me as a reader, there was a lot of discomfort reading about that, the characters' discomfort. Can you talk a little bit about that?
If you're writing about 1909 first, you have to write about the world as it was, not as you would like it to be. And if you're writing about a period like this, the free speech riots of 1909 in Spokane were incredibly violent and would have been more violent for Native American characters, for African Americans, and violent, honestly, for immigrants from all sorts of different places. And so the first responsibility of a writer is not to shy away from that. And so I think part of it is reporting accurately what that would have felt like and what would have gone on. But it's also a representation of a world that's steeped in unfairness. You're writing about, you know, Gig and Rye in the novel are hobos. They are orphaned young men who go from town to town looking for work, often being cheated out of the dollar that they pay to get a job. And so I think as a writer, you owe it to those characters and to the reader to present that world as it would be. It's also, as I said, a novel about aspiring for more, aspiring for a more just world. And so to show the world in its full measure of injustice possibly will make readers uncomfortable. You know, I think in the end, we read fiction for several reasons, one of which is to be swept away into a world that we didn't know before. But the other big reason is for empathy, to exist with characters that we weren't familiar with, or that we wouldn't have normally looked at and seen with our own eyes. And for me, watching the way in which people deal with homelessness now is sort of heartbreaking. I think this is one of the first periods in history where we look at poor people and assume they've done something to deserve it. And I've always found that to be a really awful way to live and think. And so, you know, for Gig and Rye to be on a boxcar and find a girl frozen to death in the corner of the boxcar, I think it's important to register that as human beings and as readers. And then I also think it helps in the journey that the characters are taking to see why they value so much this fight for fairness and justice and decent wages for themselves and other people.
I kind of want to linger on both your mention of Gig and this idea of the labor movement. And I'm wondering, Gig is not this character's real name. It's a nickname given to him. His real name is Gregory, correct?
Yeah. Gregory and Ryan Dolan.
Yeah. And last week, listeners heard Anne Helen Peterson talk about the gig economy and burnout in the job force. Was this nickname, Gig, a coincidence, or was it a not so subtle stick at the income inequality and the labor movement that you're actually writing about in the book?
Yeah, hopefully it's somewhat subtle. I was definitely thinking, even though I'm writing historical fiction, I'm thinking about the contemporary moment. I had initially named them Ryan and Gregory, and then as I was giving them nicknames, it wasn't like I said, oh, I must have a nickname that echoes in the present moment. But once I realized his nickname was Gig, I thought it was perfect. I mean, if you think about the way that these itinerant workers in the early part of the 20th century did their job, you showed up with your own boots, your own gloves, you paid for your food out of your pay, you paid for the job. If you cut your foot off with a saw, you had no health care, you were sent out into the world. It very much is the beginning of the gig economy. And so I did want my characters to reflect that. With Ryan's nickname being Rye, I saw it as a Rye allusion to the gig economy. There were several moments in the book where I'm speaking to readers in 2020. Some of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's speeches, the things that I think she's saying hopefully carry through the decades and are as relevant now as they were then.
And in that sense, this book is, I mean, obviously multi-layered, but there are so many sort of Easter eggs then that you're dropping to readers to kind of signal those turns and, those directions that you're going topically. And I'm wondering, on page 45 specifically, Rye is talking about his brother's book stash that he carries with him throughout his travels. He carries Jack London's White Fang and then 2/3 of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. I guess I should read too. What you're actually having Rye think in this is Rye thought the books represented something for his brother, but he wasn't sure what. What do the books, those books that you've chosen to include in the book here, what do they represent for you?
I think War and Peace is the novel that represents everything for these brothers and for me as a writer, honestly. As I was doing my research, one of those details that I was just really taken by was the idea of the Great Hobo Library. The Great Hobo Library was a vast moving library that was the exchange of books by these itinerant workers. You would be on a job site and you would say, you know, I've got Emile Zola's whatever, and that someone else would say, I've got Flaubert, you know, and they would swap books. I've got Emerson's Essays. And I loved that detail. I come from a working class family. I'm first generation college student and the first male in my family to graduate high school. And so I see books as a social escalator, as the one egalitarian promise in America that is truly possible, an education. And so for Gig and Rye, they're building their own education. They're not in school. And War and Peace, Gig has only read 2 of the 4 volumes and an epilogue, and he still considers it to be the greatest work in the English language. And I sort of loved that autodidact quality of him, that he is, that that's the kind of reader and person he is. But the book itself is about characters swept up by, in the Napoleonic Wars, swept up in a historical moment that is larger than them, that, like any wave, threatens to flatten them. And so for Gig and Rye, I think once Rye starts reading the book, I think that becomes his, it becomes a pathway almost for him to understand the world. And that's what books provide us. And so I very much was patterning the book from its structure, from its long epilogue to its to other things. I was thinking about War and Peace as I was writing it, not as a direct reference, but almost as a talisman floating above the entire book. You know, and for Rye, books in a way come to represent so much. There are two really key scenes in the book. The first is when he is in the library of a wealthy mining magnate named Lemuel Brand. It's the moment when he has this epiphany and realizes that he always knew there were layers between him and the wealthy, but to realize that there aren't 8 layers or 10 layers, but an infinite number of layers, makes him realize the unfairness of this system they're in, that they're all working for these forces that are the equivalent of today's billionaires. In that moment, he thinks about the cold millions out in the world. That's where the title comes from. That's one key moment involving books, and he asks if Lem Brand has War and Peace. And then later in the book, he goes to a Carnegie Library. The Carnegie Library is, of course, paid for by the foundation set up by the steel magnate and industrialist Andrew Carnegie. And he asks for the rest of War and Peace. And it's probably the only time he's treated decently in the entire novel. And that moment in the library, I sometimes find myself tearing up when I'm writing fiction because I'm thinking so much about my characters and what they've been through and the kindness that that librarian shows him and the way he gently pulls out those blue boarded volumes of War and Peace and connects Rye with the rest of this whole story that is, for me, one of the more moving moments in the book. And so I think that that book is the one bridge to fairness that exists in this world for them. And that's something, as a child of libraries, as someone who dreamed his way into a literary career by reading books, I take very seriously and with complete sentimentality. So.
And how do you, certainly not compare or contrast maybe, but how do you marry that idea of hope or hopefulness to I don't know, what I read to be kind of a neutrality on Rye's part. You know, he kind of gets swept up in the labor movement and in these riots in a way that didn't seem completely enthusiastic. He wasn't joining like Gig. He wasn't joining like the rest of the activists in the same way. So how do you marry those two ideas or think about them in the same space?
I mean, a novel is not an instrument of idealism. It's an instrument of realism. And I think Rye is a very realistic character. How many of us, you know, if there was a general strike called tomorrow, would quit our jobs and march in the street? And would the world necessarily be better off if we all did that? If everyone was a revolutionary, we would be in a constant state of revolution. There are two characters who land in 1964. One is Rye and the other is Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. And I think they show two very different paths. And I will not apologize for showing the revolutionary has a difficult path sometimes, but the real historical figure lived a life of amazing accomplishment. She helped found the ACLU, the chairperson of the Communist Party USA, fought for civil rights and women's rights. And so I think in the novel, you're able to see both those paths. And if Rye is, I would not call him a neutral character at all. I think he definitely makes his choices, but he, like many of us, first wants to, and I think it's because of his upbringing, he, like many of us, first wants to have a home and a meal and eventually a nice pair of gloves. And so I think he is as that character would be, and as many of us are. Late in the novel, he makes the observation that when we're in the midst of his history the way he is, it's like being in a parade. But the parade moves on and most of us are on the street watching it. And I think that's true of most of us in history. And so I wanted him to be more of an everyman and to be on the street watching as Elizabeth Gurley Flynn led the parade through town.
I kind of had to keep reminding myself as I was reading the book that these characters were so young because they, you know, were experiencing these, what seemed to me, these huge moments, life-altering, world-altering moments of activism and again, violence. So I have just one more official question. It's something that I'm trying to bring at the end of each interview and just to spotlight other books because, as you know, your book is worth spotlighting, of course, but I want to know what you're reading right now. So what books are you reading right now, Jess?
What am I reading? Let's see. A book I just finished, The Yellow House by Sarah M. Broom, is unbelievable. It's a memoir, but it's more. It's about New Orleans and about a family, and I loved that. I'm rereading True Grit, which I do every once in a while. I recently reread Stoner by John Williams, which is a terrific book. Read a great book called Fallout about John Hersey, the writer who went to Hiroshima after World War II and really for the first time reported the incredible devastation of the atomic bombs there. So those are some of the things that I've read. Cast by Isabel Wilkerson is just an unbelievable nonfiction book. I think those are the kind of highlights that I've read this last few months.
And with that, Jess, thank you so much for being here. I loved The Cold Millions. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. I'm Lauren Korn, and this has been The Right Question.